Chapter 4. Things moved very quickly after that night in San Francisco. A week later, I was in Philadelphia doing interviews when I got a call from John, who'd gone back to England, telling me that he'd bumped into Tony King at the BBC. He'd told Tony what had happened and what our plans were. Tony had gone from baffled.
Reg? Reg is gay? You're moving in together, as in moving in together.
To uproariously amused when he heard about my desire that the relationship stay low-key.
What do you mean Reg wants to keep it quiet? He's with you. Everyone who's set foot in a London gay club knows about you. He might as well hang a fucking neon sign out the window with "I am gay" written on it. I wanted to keep it quiet because I wasn't sure how people would react if they knew. I needn't have worried. None of my friends or the people I worked with cared at all. Bernie, the band, Dick James and Steve Brown. I got the feeling they were just relieved that I'd finally had sex. And outside of those circles, no one seemed to entertain the faintest possibility that I might be anything other than straight. It seems insane now that no one even raised an eyebrow when you consider what I was wearing and doing on stage. But it was a different world then. Homosexuality had only been decriminalised in Britain for 3 years. The wider public's knowledge or understanding of the subject was pretty sketchy. When we toured America, all the legendary groupies from that era, the Plastercasters and Sweet Connie from Little Rock, would turn up backstage to the evident delight of the band and road crew. I'd think, hang on, what are you doing here? Surely you're not here for me. Surely someone's told you, and even if they haven't, I've just been carried on stage by a bodybuilder while wearing half the world's supply of Diamante sequins in marabou feathers. Does that not suggest anything to you? Apparently not. I became quite adept at slipping away and locking myself in the toilet to escape their attentions. If anyone I knew felt it was odd that I was setting up home with John so soon, they didn't mention it. And as it turned out, the speed with which my relationship with John progressed was just the first indication of what I was like. I was the kind of person who met someone, immediately fell head over heels and started planning our life together. Incapable of telling a crush from real love, I could see the white picket fence and an eternity of connubial bliss before I'd even spoken to someone. Later, when I was really famous, this became a terrible problem both for me and the object of my affections. I'd insist they give up their own lives in order to follow me around on tour, with disastrous results every time. But that was in the future. I really was in love with John. That intense, guileless, naive kind of first love. And I'd just discovered sex. It made sense to move in together. Under the circumstances, my current living arrangements were hardly ideal. Straight or gay, you're going to struggle to conduct a meaningful sexual relationship with someone if you're living in your mum's spare room and your co-writer's trying to sleep in the bunk bed under yours. When I got back from America, we started looking for a flat to rent together. We found one in a development called the Water Gardens near Edgware Road. One bedroom, a bathroom, a living room and a kitchen. Bernie temporarily moved in with Steve Brown. He'd fallen in love in California too, with a girl called Maxine, who'd been on the famous day trip to Palm Springs. No wonder he'd been so eager to go. The last people I told were my mum and Durf. I waited until a few weeks after I'd moved out. I suppose I was psyching myself up. I finally decided the moment was right, the night John and I were supposed to go and see Liberace at the London Palladium. We had tickets, but I told John to go on his own. I had to ring Mum that night. I was nervous, but a phone call went okay. I told Mum I was gay and she seemed totally unsurprised. Oh, we know. We've known that for a long time. At the time, I put her knowledge of my sexuality down to the intangible mystic power of a mother's intuition, although, with the benefit of hindsight, she and Durf probably got an inkling what was going on when they helped me move my stuff into the water garden and realised that I was living in a one-bedroom flat with another man. Mum wasn't exactly thrilled by the idea that I was gay. She said something about condemning myself to a life of loneliness, which didn't seem to make a huge amount of sense given that I was in a relationship, but at least she hadn't disowned me or refused to accept it. And bizarrely, when he got home, I noticed that John looked like he'd had a much more stressful evening than I had. It turned out that midway through the show, Liberace had unexpectedly announced that he had a very special guest in the audience, a wonderful new singer who was going to be a big star. And I know he's here tonight, and I'm going to make him stand up and wave to you all because he is so fabulous. Elton John!
Assuming that my reluctance to make myself known was down to modesty, Liberace had become progressively more solicitous.
Come on now, Elton, don't be shy. The audience want to meet you. Don't you want to meet Elton John, ladies and gentlemen? I tell you, this guy's gonna be huge. Let's give him a big hand and see if we can't get him to say hello.
While a huge spotlight vainly circled the stalls. In John's telling of the story, Liberace had carried on like this for about 3 weeks, during which time the audience had grown first restless, then audibly irritated at my churlish refusal to show myself. Meanwhile, the one person among them who actually knew Elton John's whereabouts had grown concerned he was going to become the first person in history to literally die of embarrassment. Eventually, Liberace had given up. According to John, he was still smiling, but something about the way he launched into Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody suggested murderous fury. Ruining a Liberace concert while coming out to my parents notwithstanding, life was heaven. I was finally able to be who I was, to have no fear about myself, to have no fear about sex. I mean it in the nicest possible way when I say John taught me how to be debauched. As Tony had noted, John really knew the gay scene, the clubs and the pubs. We'd go to the Vauxhall Tavern to see Lee Sutton, this great drag queen.
The name is Lee Sutton, DSM, OBE, dirty sex maniac on the bed with everybody.
And to the Sombrero Club on Kensington High Street. We would have dinner parties and other musicians would drop by. One night, after we went to see him play live, Neil Young came back home with us and after a few drinks, elected to perform his forthcoming album in its entirety for us at 2 a.m. Already alerted to the fact that an impromptu party was going on by the nerve-jangling sound of my friend Kiki D drunkenly walking into a glass door while holding a tray containing every champagne glass we owned, the delight of the adjoining flats at Neil Young performing his forthcoming album was audible. So that's how I heard the classic Heart of Gold for the first time, presented in a unique arrangement of solo piano, voice, and neighbour intermittently banging on the ceiling with a broom handle and loudly imploring Neil Young to shut up. My career suddenly had real momentum. We weren't as big in Britain as we were in the US, but the band and I had come back from America with a new sense of purpose. We'd been validated, ratified by so many people over there that we knew we were onto something. Word of what had happened in Los Angeles had filtered back to Britain, and the press was suddenly interested. A hippie magazine called Friends sent a journalist to interview me. I played him two tracks we'd already recorded for the next album, Tumbleweed Connection, and in the subsequent article he went as nuts as Robert Hilburn had done. I think that along with his lyricist he will possibly become the finest and almost certainly the most popular songwriter in England and eventually the world. We played the Royal Albert Hall, supporting Fotheringay, a band formed by Fairport Convention's former lead singer Sandy Denny. Like the audience at the Troubadour, they thought they were getting a sensitive singer-songwriter. The perfect complement to what they did, which was wistful folk rock. And instead, they got rock and roll and Mr. Freedom clothes and handstands on the piano keyboard. They couldn't follow us. We had so much adrenaline and confidence. Of course, when the adrenaline wore off and I realised what we'd done, I felt terrible. Sandy Denny was one of my heroes, an amazing vocalist. It was meant to be their big showcase gig, and I'd ruined it for them. I scuttled home, absolutely mortified, before they came on stage. But it felt like the time was right. The 60s were over, the Beatles had split up, and there was a new wave of artists that were all starting to make it at the same time. Me, Rod Stewart, Mark Bolan, David Bowie. Musically, we were all very different, but in some ways we were birds of a feather. We were all working-class Londoners. We'd all spent the 60s with our noses pressed against the glass, toiling away on the same club circuit, never really getting where we wanted to go. And we all knew each other. Our paths had crossed backstage in R&B clubs and at gigs at the Roundhouse. I was never great friends with Bowie. I loved his music, and we socialised a couple of times, visiting the Sombrero with Tony King and having dinner together in Covent Garden while he was rehearsing for the Ziggy Stardust tour. But there was always something distant and aloof about him, at least when I was around. I honestly don't know what the problem was, but there clearly was a problem. Years later, he'd always make snippy remarks about me in interviews. The token queen of rock and roll was the most famous one. Although, in fairness, he was absolutely out of his mind on coke when he said it. But I adored Mark and Rod. They couldn't have been more different. Mark seemed to have come from another planet. There was something otherworldly about him, as if he was just passing through Earth on his way to somewhere else. You could hear it in his music. Ride a White Swan was never off the radio when we moved into the Water Garden. And it didn't sound like anything else. You couldn't work out where he was coming from. That's what he was like in person. He was larger than life, straight but very camp, and incredibly kind and gentle at the same time. He clearly had a big ego, but he also never seemed to take himself seriously at all. He somehow managed to be simultaneously completely charming and absolutely brazenly full of shit. He'd say the most outrageous things with a straight face. Darling, I sold a million records this morning. I'd think, Mark, no one in the history of music has ever sold a million records in a morning, let alone you. But something about him was so beguiling and endearing, you'd never actually say that out loud. Instead, you'd find yourself agreeing with him. A million, Mark! Congratulations! How fabulous! I'd known about Rod for years because of the connection with Long John Baldry, but I only really got to know him after he covered Country Comfort, one of the new songs that I'd played the journalist from Friends. He changed the lyrics. Something I complained about at length in the press. He sounds like he made it up as he went along. He couldn't have got further from the original if he'd sung the Camptown Races. That rather set the tone for our friendship. We've got a lot in common. We both love football and collecting art. We both grew up after the war in families that didn't have a lot, so neither of us have never been coy about enjoying the fruits of our success, shall we say. But the thing we really share is our sense of humour. For a man with a well-documented lifelong obsession with leggy blondes, Rod's got a surprisingly camp sense of humour. He happily joined in when we started giving ourselves drag names back in the 70s. I was Sharon, John was Beryl, Tony was Joy, and Rod was Phyllis. We've spent nearly 50 years constantly taking the piss out of and trying to put one over each other. When the press were speculating about my hair falling out and whether or not I'd started wearing a hairpiece, Rod could be relied upon to send me a present. One of those old-fashioned, helmet-shaped hairdryers that old women used to sit under in salons. Keen to reciprocate his thoughtfulness, I sent him a Zimmer frame covered in fairy lights. Even today, if I notice he's got an album out that's selling better than mine, I know it's only a matter of time before I'm going to get an email. Hello, Sharon. Just wanted to write to say I'm so sorry that your record's not in the top 100, dear. What a pity when mine's doing so well. Love, Phyllis. It reached a kind of peak in the early 80s when Rod was playing Earl's Court. They had advertised the gig by flying a blimp over the venue with his face on it. I was staying in London that weekend and I could see it from my hotel room window. It was too good an opportunity to miss. So I called my management and they hired someone to shoot it down. Apparently it landed on top of a double-decker bus and was last seen heading towards Putney. About an hour later, the phone went. It was Rod, spluttering about the disappearance. Where's my fucking balloon gone? It was you, wasn't it, you cow? You bitch! A year later, I was playing Olympia and the promoters had hung a huge banner across the street. It was mysteriously cut down immediately after it was put up. The phone call that informed me of this sabotage came from Rod, who seemed curiously well informed about exactly what had happened. Oh, such a shame about your banner, love. I heard it wasn't even up 5 minutes. I bet you didn't even get to see it. Not long after we moved into the Water Gardens, I was back in America for another tour. It's a huge country, and most of it couldn't care less if the LA Times has called you the future of rock and roll. You have to get out there and show people what you can do. Besides, we had another album to promote. Tumbleweed Connection was already finished. Recorded in March 1970 and released in the UK in the October. That's just how it was then. You didn't take 3 years to make an album. You recorded quick, you got it out fast, you kept the momentum going, kept things fresh. It suited the way I worked. I hate wasting time in the studio. I suppose it's a legacy from my days as a session musician. Or recording demos in the middle of the night at DJM. You were always working against the clock. So we crisscrossed the states, usually playing as a support act for Leon Russell, The Byrds, Poco, The Kinks and Eric Clapton's new band, Derek and the Dominoes. That was the idea of my booking agent. Howard rose, and a really clever move. Don't play top of the bill. Play second. Make people want to come back and see you again in your own right. Every artist we supported was incredibly kind and generous to us, but it was hard work. Each night we'd go on stage with the intention of stealing the show. We'd go down great and come off thinking we'd blown the headliners off stage, and every night the headliners would come out and play better than us. People talk about Derek and the Dominoes being a real disaster area. Strung out on heroin and booze, but you would never have known that if you'd seen them live that autumn. They were phenomenal. From the side of the stage, I took mental notes about their performance. Eric Clapton was the star, but it was their keyboard player, Bobby Whitlock, that I watched like a hawk. He was from Memphis, learned his craft hanging around Stax Studios, and played with that soulful, deep southern gospel feel. Touring with them or Leon was like being on the road with Patti LaBelle or Major Lance when I was in Bluesology. You watched and you learned from people who had more experience than you. If we still had a long way to go, it was clear on that tour that the word was spreading. In LA, we had dinner with Danny Hutton from Three Dog Night, and he casually mentioned that Brian Wilson wanted to meet us. Really? I had idolised the Beach Boys in the 60s, but their career had tailed off, and Brian Wilson had turned into this mysterious mythic figure. According to some lurid gossip, he was supposed to have become a recluse, or gone insane, or both. Oh no, Danny assured us. He's a huge fan. He'd love you to visit. So we drove up to his house in Bel Air, a Spanish-style mansion with an intercom at the gate. Danny buzzed it and announced he was here with Elton John. There was a deathly silence at the other end. Then there was a voice, unmistakably that of the Beach Boys mastermind, singing the chorus of Your Song. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind. As we approached the front door, it opened to reveal Brian Wilson himself. He looked fine, a little chubbier than on the cover of Pet Sounds, perhaps, but nothing like the reclusive weirdo people gossiped about. We said hello. He stared at us and nodded. Then he sang the chorus of Your Song. Again. He said we should come upstairs and meet his kids. It turned out that his kids were asleep in bed. He woke them up. This is Elton John, he enthused. His daughters looked understandably baffled. He sang the chorus of Your Song to them. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind. Then he sang the chorus of Your Song to us again. By now, the novelty of hearing the chorus of Your Song sung to me by one of pop history's true geniuses was beginning to wear a little thin. I was struck by the sinking feeling that we were in for quite a long and trying evening. I turned to Bernie and a certain look passed between us that somehow managed to combine fear, confusion and the fact that we were both desperately trying not to laugh at the absolute preposterousness of the situation we found ourselves in. A look that said, what the fuck is happening? It was a look that we grew increasingly accustomed to using during the last months of 1970. I was invited to a party at Mama Cass Elliott's house on Woodrow Wilson Drive in LA. Famed as the leading hangout for Laurel Canyon's musicians, the place where Crosby, Stills and Nash had formed and David Crosby had shown off his new discovery, a singer-songwriter called Joni Mitchell, to his friends. When I arrived, they were all there. It was nuts, like the record sleeves in the bedroom at Froom Court had come to life. What the fuck is happening? We passed Bob Dylan on the stairs at the Fillmore East. And he stopped, introduced himself, then told Bernie he loved the lyrics of a song from Tumbleweed called My Father's Gun. What the fuck is happening? We were sitting backstage after a gig in Philadelphia when the dressing room door opened and five men walked in unannounced. You couldn't mistake the band for anyone else. They looked like they'd just stepped off the cover of the album we'd played to death back in England. Robbie Robertson and Richard Manuel started telling us they'd flown in from Massachusetts by private plane just to see the show, while I tried to behave as if the band flying in from Massachusetts to see me perform was a perfectly normal state of affairs, and occasionally stole a glance at Bernie, who was similarly engaged in a desperate attempt to play it cool. A year ago, we were dreaming of trying to write songs like them, and now they're stood in front of us asking us to play them on our new album. What the fuck is happening? It wasn't just the band who wanted to meet us. It was their managers, Albert Grossman and Bennett Glotzer. They were legendary American music business figures, particularly Grossman, a renowned tough guy who'd managed Bob Dylan since the early 60s. He had reacted to another client, Janis Joplin, becoming addicted to heroin, not by intervening, but by taking a life insurance policy out on her. Word must have reached them that I was currently without a manager. Ray Williams was a lovely man. I owed him a great deal, and he was incredibly loyal. He'd even named his daughter Amarina after another of the Tumbleweed Connection songs. But after the first American trip, I'd talked it over with the rest of the band, and no one thought he was the right person to look after us. But nor were Grossman and Glotzer, as I realised the moment I met them. They were like characters from a film. A film that had been panned for its hopelessly cartoonish depiction of two aggressive, motor-mouthed American showbiz managers. Nevertheless, they were real people, and their collective efforts to win me over succeeded in scaring me witless. As long as there was a vacancy, they were not going to leave me alone. "I'm going to follow you around until you sign for me," Glotzer told me. He wasn't joking. There seemed to be no way of getting rid of him short of applying for a restraining order. Once again, the allure of locking myself in the toilet became hard to resist. It might have been while I was in hiding from Bennett Glotzer that I started thinking about getting John to manage me. The more I considered it, the more it made sense. John was young and ambitious and full of adrenaline. He'd grown up in working-class Paisley in the 50s and 60s, an experience which had left him tough enough to deal with anything the music business threw at him. We were already a couple, which meant that he'd have my best interests at heart. He was a born hustler with the gift of the gab, and he was brilliant at his job. He didn't just know music, he was smart about music. Earlier in the year, he'd personally convinced Motown to release a 3-year-old album track by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles as a single, then watched as Tears of a Clown went to number one on both sides of the Atlantic. It sold so many copies that Smokey Robinson had to put his plans to retire from music on hold. Everyone agreed it was a good idea, including John. He quit EMI and Motown at the end of the year, got a desk in Dick James's office, initially at least he was effectively an employee of DJM, given a salary to act as a kind of liaison between me and the company, and that was that. To celebrate, we traded in my Ford Escort for an Aston Martin. It was the first really extravagant thing I ever bought. The first sign I was actually making good money from music. We got it off Morris Gibb from the Bee Gees, and it was a real pop star's car. A purple DB6, flashy and beautiful. And completely impractical, as we discovered when John had to meet Martha and the Vandellas off their flight at Heathrow Airport. It was one of his last jobs for Motown, and we proudly took the Aston Martin along. Martha and the Vandellas looked impressed until they realised they had to get into the back of it. The designers had clearly spent considerably more time on its sleek lines and poetic contours than they had worrying about whether the rear seats could house a legendary soul trio. Somehow they got in. Perhaps Motown's famous charm school had given classes on contortionism. As I drove back down the A40, I looked in the rearview mirror. It was like a Tokyo tube train during rush hour back there. Hang on. Martha and the Vandellas were crammed into the back of my car, which was an Aston Martin. That would have seemed very strange 12 months ago when I was driving a Ford Escort, its back seat noticeably devoid of Motown superstars. But after the year I'd had, strange was becoming a relative concept. I didn't have too much time to ruminate on how my life had changed. I was working too hard. We spent 1971 touring, backwards and forwards between America and Britain, then down to Japan, New Zealand and Australia. We were headlining now, but we still followed Howard Rose's advice and played venues that were slightly smaller than we could fill. Or one night in a city when we could have sold out too. We did the same thing in Britain. We kept playing the universities and rock clubs long after we could have filled theatres. It's a really smart thing to do. Don't be greedy. Build your career up gradually. And it was typical Howard. He was so bright and full of good advice. He's still my agent today. I was really lucky with the people I worked with when I was just starting out in America. Young British artists could easily fall in with a bunch of sharks over there, but I got people who went out of their way to make me feel part of a family. Not just Howard, but my publisher David Rosner and his wife Margot. If I wasn't on stage, I was in the studio. I released 4 albums in America in 1971. Tumbleweed Connection didn't come out there until January. The soundtrack to a movie called Friends in March, which was only a minor hit but still did better than the film, a complete flop. A live album we'd recorded the previous year, 11-17-70, in May, and Madman Across the Water in November. We recorded Madman in 4 days. It was supposed to be 5, but we lost the day because of Paul Buckmaster. He stayed up the night before the sessions began to finish the arrangements. I suspect with a certain amount of chemical assistance. Then managed to knock a bottle of ink all over the only score, ruining it. I was furious. It was an expensive mistake to make, and we stopped working together for decades afterwards. But I was also quietly impressed when he wrote the whole score again in 24 hours. Even when Paul screwed up, he screwed up in a way that reminded you he was a genius. And I love Madman Across the Water. At the time, it was a much bigger hit in America than in Britain. Top 10 over there, but only number 41 at home. It's not particularly commercial. There were no huge smash singles, and the songs were much longer and more complex than I'd written before. Some of Bernie's lyrics were like a diary of the last year. One song, All the Nasties, was about me wondering aloud what would happen if I came out publicly. If it came to pass that they should ask, what would I tell them? Would they criticise behind my back? Maybe I should let them. Not a single person seemed to notice what I was singing about. One other thing happened during the Madman sessions. Gus Dudgeon hired a guitarist called Davy Johnston to play acoustic guitar and mandolin on a couple of tracks. I really liked him. He was Scottish, lanky and very forthright, and he had a really good taste in music. I took Gus aside and asked what he thought about Davy joining the band. I'd been thinking about expanding the trio to include a guitarist for a while. Gus thought it was a bad idea. Davy was a wonderful guitarist, but he only played acoustic. As far as Gus knew, he'd never even played an electric guitar. He was in a band called Magna Carta, who specialised in bucolic folk, and there wasn't a lot of that in the Elton John repertoire. It was a very persuasive argument. I ignored it and offered Davy the job anyway. If I had learned anything over the last few years, it was that sometimes a gut feeling is the most important thing. You can work as hard as you like and plan as carefully as you want, but there are moments when it's just about a hunch, about trusting your instincts, or about fate. What if I'd never responded to the Liberty advert? What if I'd passed the audition and they hadn't given me Bernie's lyrics? What if Steve Brown hadn't showed up at DJM? What if Dick hadn't been so certain I should go to America when it seemed like such a stupid idea? So when we went to France to record the next album at the Chateau d'Erreville, Davy was with us. I'd changed things around a lot. It was the first time I'd tried to record an album with my touring band rather than crack session musicians. The first time that Davy had picked up an electric guitar. The first time we'd had the money to record abroad in a residential studio. But I was in a really confident mood. Just before we left for France, I'd legally changed my name to Elton John. Elton Hercules John. I'd always thought middle names were slightly ridiculous, so I did the most ridiculous thing I could think of and took mine from the Rag and Bone Man's horse in the sitcom Steptoe and Son. Basically, I had got sick of the fuss in shops where the cashier recognised me but not the name on my chequebook. But it really seemed more symbolic than practical. Like I was finally, conclusively, legally leaving Reg Dwight behind. Fully becoming the person I was supposed to be. As it turned out, it wasn't quite as simple as that. But in that moment, it felt good. I loved the idea of working at the Chateau. Even though it came with a reputation attached, it was supposed to be haunted, and the locals had apparently become wary of the studio's clientele after the Grateful Dead had stayed there, offered to play a free concert for the villagers, then taking it upon themselves to expand the minds of rural France by spiking their audience drinks with LSD. But it was a beautiful building, an 18th century mansion. We ended up naming the album after it, Honky Chateau, and I was excited about the idea of having to write songs on the spot. I'm not a musician who walks around with melodies in his head all the time. I don't rush to the piano in the middle of the night when inspiration strikes. I don't even think about songwriting when I'm not actually doing it. Bernie writes the words, gives them to me. I read them, play a chord, and something else takes over. Something comes through my fingers. The muse, god, luck. You can give it a name if you want, but I've no idea what it is. I just know straight away where the melody's going to go. Sometimes a song only takes as long to write as it does to listen to. Sad Songs Say So Much was like that. I sat down, read the lyric, and played it pretty much as you hear it on the record. Sometimes it takes a bit longer. If I don't like what I've done after about 40 minutes, I give up and move on to something else. There are words that Bernie's written that I've never managed to come up with music for. He wrote a great lyric called The Day That Bobby Went Electric about hearing Dylan sing Subterranean Homesick Blues for the first time, and I just couldn't get a tune I thought was right. I tried 4 or 5 times, but I've never had writer's block. I've never sat down with one of Bernie's lyrics and nothing has come out. I don't know why. I can't explain it, and I don't want to explain it. Actually, I love that I can't explain it. It's the spontaneity of it that's beautiful. So Bernie brought his typewriter to the chateau, and we set up some instruments in the dining room as well as the studio. Bernie would bash out his lyrics and leave them for me on the piano. I'd wake up early, go to the dining room, see what he'd come up with, and write songs while I was having breakfast. The first morning we were there, I had 3 done by the time the band drifted downstairs looking for something to eat. Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters, Amy, and Rocket Man. Once Davey had been convinced that this wasn't an elaborate prank at the expense of the new boy, that I really had written 3 songs while he was having a lie-in, he picked up his guitar and asked me to play Rocket Man again. He didn't add a solo or do anything that a regular lead guitar player might do. He used a slide and played odd, lonely notes that drifted around and away from the melody. It was great. Like I said, sometimes a gut feeling is the most important thing. Sometimes you have to trust fate. The rest of the band was so used to playing together that there was something almost telepathic between us. They just intuitively knew what to do with a song without being told. It felt fantastic, sitting together in the chateau's dining room, hearing a song take shape around us, trying ideas and knowing straight away they were the right ideas. There's times in my life when music has been an escape. The only thing that worked when everything else seemed broken, but at that moment, I had nothing to escape from. I was 24, successful, settled and in love. What's more, tomorrow we had a day off, and I was going to Paris, with every intention of absolutely looting the Yves Saint Laurent store.